We should reconvene. I'm sorry, we've gone a little over our time. So our next measure is 1531, follow-up assessment of stroke or death after carotid revascularization.
Tis I. Okay, so this is an interesting initiative that is actually a process measure. It is not an outcomes measure. It's a measurement of how frequently an examination was done within 21 to 60 days following a procedure. The interesting part is, so here's the challenge there that we talked around and about earlier today on other procedures that are where a measurement is requested following discharge. The added feature to this one is that the exam then is requested or required to be done by someone who is certified by the stroke NIH stroke scale certified, and it's also specified that it not be done by the operator, so that the surgeon involved is not the person. So when we discussed this on the phone, a couple issues came up. One, of course, was the feasibility and the likelihood of being able to retrieve this information subsequent to a procedure being done, particularly because the hospitalization is so short that it just isn't going to happen then, obviously, in 21 to 60 days. So it's the issue there, and also the issue of certification. And if there are changes noted in the exam, if it was done by someone certified at 21 days, and the initial baseline exam was done by someone not certified, then does it count or does it not count? So I think the consensus is that it makes sense. I think it really is a feasibility issue more than anything else.
To me, this measure seems like an effort to gather research data rather than quality data. We've had a couple today that have kind of had that flavor, like the reason to have this measure is to generate data for somebody's paper about strokes after carotid. Is there any evidence here that this will improve patient outcomes?
We have a comment from the developer. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? What was that?
This is a process measure, as mentioned. I think to have a process measure for quality purposes, it has to be strongly linked to an outcome. So how does doing this additional assessment improve patient outcomes?
Well, it's part of obtaining outcomes, outcomes assessment. It's an independent neurological exam based on the NIH SS stroke scale, which is a relatively simple clinical tool which many people can use to try to find out if a neurological event has occurred. And the idea is to be able, for internal quality purposes at institutions or for reporting, public reporting, to try to track clinical outcomes, particularly neurological outcomes. But if you don't have a uniform standardized tool for assessing that, then it becomes a little bit problematic. And you have institutions that don't do it at all or that aren't obtaining quality data. So the idea around the tool, the simple clinical tool, is to provide a little bit of a standardization of assessments.
Another question that came up along those lines, Dr. Rogers sort of referred to it before, was that why not do this during the hospitalization, since the majority of incidents happen soon after the procedure? And from a feasibility standpoint, that would also be easier to make sure you have somebody who's not the provider who performed the procedure doing it, because you could have, say, a nurse on the floor. The tool is very simple, because I actually looked at it online after our phone discussion.
Well, the background behind that was that, of course, patients should have exams done before and after the procedure, and the expectation is that they will. Some clinical events happen after discharge. in the, although it's oftentimes not reported as such when the trials are published, most of the clinical trials use a 30-day endpoint. However, a few of them delve into the occurrence of events in hospital and those after discharge in up to 30 days. And they were very little bit, but about 10 to 25% of the neurological events occurred after discharge, between discharge and 30 days. So you do miss a substantial number of them if you only obtain hospitalization data. And since most of the evidence base is centered around 30 days, the proposal was that 30 days with a window, 30 days become an acceptable reporting point.
And this is Susan Fitzgerald from the ACC, and I just want to say that the specifications are that the examiner should be independent, doesn't have to be, but we recommend that they should be. It's so apparently a more valid test if somebody other than the operator performs it. And I think about between 96 and 98% of the NIH stroke scales that come through our registry, the examiner is certified. They are a certified examiner. They've gotten their NIH certification.
I guess I should know this. Tell me again, or remind me, where this data is collected.
Well, it begins at the hospital. It begins at the institution.
But where does it end up?
Yeah. Well, for the ones that participate in our registry, they accumulate the data and transmit it to the ACC.
So it raises the issue of belonging to a registry once again. And can you tell us what options there might be with the information?
Well, of course, we would like for all institutions to collect their own data and engage in quality improvement initiatives and do public reporting on their own without participating in registries, but the trend has been to do at least regional-based or sometimes nationally-based registries for doing comparisons between institutions to try to look at variability and quality improvement initiatives on a larger scale, and we support that too. But the level of collection is at the institution. We currently have about 178 sites that participate and have about 15,000 records on carotid revascularization, and the data is transmitted to a central warehouse where it undergoes analysis, and there are reports generated back to the participating sites on a quarterly and then an annual basis for them to review their data. Of course, we hope that they'd review their own data anyway, since they're the ones that sent it to us for internal purposes. But we were able to provide some comparative analysis of the various institutions.
One of the assumptions that was stated in the measure at the beginning is that everyone obviously has an office visit following surgery, and I think that isn't always an accurate assumption, number one. And number two, since this requires a visit to someone other than the surgeon, I think that's a really big assumption that everyone already will have a visit. There also, the numerator time window, as we've seen on a lot of other measures, doesn't match what's described in the numerator. It also seems like there should be exclusions for people who died, because people who died wouldn't be available for follow-up. And also people with a prior neurologic event or a prior stroke, it seems like there should be some way addressing those people, perhaps, in the measure as well.
Although I think that what they're saying is, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense of the measure is just that the exam was done. Not that there was a change, but just that the exam was done. So I understand why they don't have necessarily prior sentences, are not making a comparison. They just want to make sure somebody's actually examining the patient sometimes. But I still wonder about making it 21 to 30 days instead of some time period after the surgery. Because, most of the practice I've seen, they see their post-op patients a week or two later. It may not be at 21 days, and they would fall outside that window.
Wouldn't it tend to be a bias on the data? That is, if you had a stroke, you're more likely to go back and see your doctor?
You might go back to see a doctor. It might not be the person who's involved in the procedure or necessarily related to the institution where they came from.
Could I ask what's a fairly obvious question here? This is an American College of Cardiology measure. And so I assume we're talking about carotid stenting predominantly and cardiology practice predominantly?
Yeah. No, the registry that we operate is actually a partnership between 8 societies, including the American College of Cardiology, the American Academy of Neurological Surgeons, the College of Neurological Surgeons. So it's a partnership. All societies have input, and they all help develop the various measures and reporting standards. So it's a conjoint effort that's involved in this.
Is it endarterectomy as well as stenting?
Yes, we have. We try to capture and encourage reporting on all types of revascularization, both endarterectomies as well as stenting. And the data that we've accumulated so far is roughly equal between the two types of procedures. Last year, for 2010, there were 2,500 endarterectomies and 2,500 carotid stents that were submitted to the registry.
Is SVS involved in your registry?
SVS has been involved in several levels. There are discussions going on with them right now about partnering up, as was discussed earlier for this. In terms of the organizational, no, they're not one of the 8 groups that are involved right now. But that continues to be discussed.
Can you speak to the 21 to 60 day window that was raised?
Well, what we find is that people submit records on follow-up, and they submit the date of follow-up. And we wanted to do, and we understand that there's some patients have follow-up at 7 days, but if you have a patient who has a follow-up at 7 days and other people are submitting follow-up that's, you know, much greater than 30 days, we find we can't compare the two groups. So we created that follow-up window to be consistent. Look at a couple of your questions. That was one question. The other one was that if you died, you would be counted because you're assessing. You would not expect to have a stroke scale if you died. If you died in the hospital or knew that the patient died within 30 days, submitted a follow-up record, you did the assessment accurately. And then the third thing is prior strokes are not excluded. Evolving strokes and dissection are excluded because carotid endarterectomies and stenting are typically done on an elective basis to prevent strokes. So if a patient is very sick who's coming in, really not supposed to have procedures like that, but do, we excluded them in the follow-up because their stroke rates are higher and their assessment and follow-up is a little different.
One other comment is that for the last decade, the clinical trials that have been published on carotid revascularization have pretty much all centered around a 30-day assessment. And with the window, it's varied between 15 to 40, 25 to 60, but those numbers were chosen as a sort of average value from the clinical evidence base from the trials that have been published over the last 10 years. So the 21 to 60 works out to be roughly a window, average window, around 30.
Can you give us some idea about the relationship of the numbers of reported cases you had last year versus an estimate of the number of cases that are done in the country for the year? So are we talking 10% or 25%? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I don't think we have those. For 2010, I don't think we have an estimate on that.
So the question has been asked by Vivian and has to do with, do you see yourself as a competing entity with SVS or others for that matter? And I wonder whether there's a possibility of harmonizing with some of the stuff they do, perish the thought.
I mean, that would be the idea, is to have, a registry where we all agree on what the data points are going to be.
Right, and there's a physician that is I think, the president of SDS, that's very close to a position at the college, and they both work at the same center, who has kind of forged some recent conversations about partnering and moving forward with carotid as well as peripheral vascular initiatives. So, you know, we did not, when we first launched the registry, we actually had conversations about it, but our registry launched and so did theirs, and it was kind of too late. So we reintroduced those conversations.
I had a question about feasibility. I mean, if you say that it doesn't have to be the same person that does the procedure, what if they have a procedure and they go see their general practitioner? I mean, first of all, you got to get them to be certified on this scale, the NIH scale. So you've already made it very difficult to some extent, even though it's an easy thing to do and they can get it offline. But then how are we going to capture the data that they had a carotid here at this major center that they got referred to, and then they follow up with their neurologist in, you know, Boise, Montana, or Boise, Idaho, sorry. And what's the feasibility of doing it? Are you saying they have to be in a registry then? Because you don't want to go down that road, because we've been down that road a couple times. What are we saying here, Jeff?
Well, but
how are you going to do the follow-up? So I'm just looking at the usability and feasibility aspect.
Well, I think, as was mentioned earlier, the responsibility doesn't stop when the patient leaves the hospital, that people that are engaged in carotid revascularization have a responsibility to have some sort of follow-up over what happened to the patient. And that includes a neurological examination. It's easy enough to transmit reports. And we hope that the responsible operator would have enough of a relationship with referring physicians, should they be located far away, to get some report back. And that at least at the institutional level, that ought to be a relatively common quality type initiative that institutions, hospitals, should be engaged in. And that there probably are some cases where there may be a distance between the patient where they get their follow-up and the operating center, but hopefully that will be harmonized, especially in this increasing age of electronic transmission of medical record data, so that getting back a report ought not to be all that difficult. It ought to become expected.
I agree with you that people who do these procedures should follow up their patients afterward. I don't think you've really answered the question of what do the vascular surgeons do who follow up their patients in, say, 7 to 14 days, so they're not inside of this window, but are perfectly responsible and perfectly interested in providing high-quality care. And then I have a second point which I'd like you to also address, and that is in the 2B and 2C area of this, reliability and validity testing. I'm wondering if Group D discussed this in your conference call previously, and if you could clarify a little bit about those blank places in the reliability and validity testing areas. So two questions. One is, can you talk a little bit more about the window? Because if a vascular surgeon follows up between 7 and 14 days, they're not within this window. And then the second part is the testing.
Well, the window was chosen as a kind of averaging phenomenon. The discussion around that was that 7 days was too soon. That a later time point, because events do happen, was a more preferable time point, and that that ought to become more ingrained and embedded. We can't force people to do these exams or do this reporting, but the desire was that it should be between 21 and 60 days based upon the evidence that's out there in terms of clinical trial data for both forms of revascularization and the occurrence of events after discharge up to 30 days. But the window, roughly 21 to 60 days, was acceptable. There are trial data out there that are as short as 15 days. I don't know of any that are as short as 7, but certainly 15 days and extending out to around 60, 65 days. That 7 was considered to be a little too soon.
Again, why isn't this an outcome measure? I mean, if you're putting this much precision into measuring every patient in a very precise way, why not report the outcomes?
Perfect. That's an excellent question, and obviously everybody would like to move that way toward an outcome assessment and reporting of an outcomes. In order to be fair, it would have to be a risk-adjusted outcome or risk-standardized outcomes, and we're moving in that direction. There are risk models do not exist yet, but in order to get to those outcomes and risk-adjusted outcomes, you have to have a process for ascertaining the outcome, and the process is doing a standardized neurological examination. Without the neurological examination being done, you really don't have a fair assessment of the outcome.
Just a suggestion on the best of breed theory, the idea of maybe doing this kind of follow-up on only on asymptomatic patients where risk adjustment, as we've learned today, is of minor significance, might be a way to thread that needle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the follow-up time frame of the 0 to 14 days, it's interesting. I think as ACC, we think more of the stenting and not as much the endarterectomy in the follow-up. The operators to perform the stenting, you know, we've talked to them about this, and that seems to be an appropriate time frame. We could drop the front end of it, but we did want to compare patients that went into a doctor at 7 days with a patient who was going in 45 days with different outcomes.
Yeah, we tend to see the patients early, just want to see what their neck infection is, especially if they're getting a little swelling or, you know.
Right, and that's a really good point, and we could drop that end of it. And the other thing I wanted to mention is in working with interventionalists and some cardiac surgeons, we always have struggled to report myocardial infarction and some other outcomes after a PCI or surgery, and it's because some hospitals report assess it differently than others. And we work with a lot of payer programs, and we identify which of our metrics and measures are appropriate to use in a pay-for-performance program or not. And MI is never it, because some hospitals have an MI rate of 7% because they check biomarkers on every single patient, and others don't. So we have always stressed the importance of a proper assessment in a patient post-op. We actually did a really interesting paper on PCIs. Hospitals that check biomarkers routinely had a much higher quality hospital. They had lower mortality rate. They had much higher adherence to process outcomes, medications prescribed at discharge and stuff like that. It was interesting.
There's no doubt that you find problems proportionate to how carefully you look for them. I think the answer may be fairly straightforward, but the reliability and validity testing, this is obviously a binary question, either the exam was done or not, but do you have any testing of this that you could fill us in on?
What we have is performance rates in our registry, so we haven't audited the data to compare it to medical record or something like that to get reliability data.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
We haven't established reliability by comparing to medical record or something like that, but we have distribution of performance within the registry.
I just keep thinking, if I were the patient who had had this procedure done, and it's 3 weeks later, I've been and I've had my follow-up visit with Vivian, and she checked my neck, and I was fine. I'm alert, I'm oriented, I'm back at work, I'm functioning normally, I know I'm alive, I know I didn't have a stroke. Why in the world would I, the patient, want to take time off work to go see some doctor I'd never seen to have an exam to see whether I had a stroke? And then I have to pay out of pocket because I have a copayment or coinsurance or whatever. I mean, and that's where I'm stuck, is why would I ever bother to do that?
Now, is there any evidence that you find more events this way than what the previous two measures find?
Are you asking about between hospital discharge and 30 days?
Sure.
Yeah, the again, based upon the reporting from trial data, it's that roughly 10 to 25% of the neurological events occur after discharge, up to 30 days.
How long after discharge? So, like, would you catch most of them at 7 days or 14 days or something that's more reasonable for us who would want to follow up on other aspects of our post-op care?
Or would you catch them because the patient says, I'm not right, I need to go see my doctor?
Yeah, well, the in the trials, everybody had the neurological exam, so for the trial data, there's better homogeneity of assessment. Sure, after 7 days, it's a declining function. Where you draw that boundary is you know, based on a lot of things, including the ease. And 7 days would be okay. I mean, the threshold could be set at 7 days. That would not be difficult to do.
Just to follow up on Carol's point, though, is I'm looking at it from the value add to the patient. So if we set it 7 days, 20 days, or whatever, but how many patients sit at home with a facial droop and don't go see anyone? I mean, how many extra, why are we, you're going to have every single person that has surgery, has been seen, has their follow-up visit, their global is all paid for. Now they have to go make another doctor's appointment. What's the value add to that? For the patient and for the payer and for Medicare, what is the value add?
Well, actually, the discussions that we participated in were actually the other direction. It was, if you were comparing institutions, A to B to C to D, and you were looking at their reported complication rates or reported event rates, and you knew that Hospital A was collecting excellent quality data and had lots of exams being done, neurological exams, and Hospital B wasn't, how reliable would you feel, how comfortable would you feel as a patient, say, if you or your relative had to go to A or B or C? So when the discussions were occurring, it was actually the reverse side of that, and looking at it and how can you compare institutions, knowing that one might be doing a really good job of collecting data and another one might not.
I think what he may be asking is the later exam, how much value, going to a different provider to get an exam, is your suggestion is that it's somebody other than the person providing the procedure. How much does that improve quality?
Probably a lot. The most of the neurologists I work with, the examiner is a nurse in the office, so the follow up exam generally occurs, and one of the nurses who is stroke certified does the exam, fills out the form, and actually faxes it over.
I'd like to say something about that. You say that it probably improves the quality a lot, but we don't really know because all you have is a distribution. You haven't really tested it, so we don't actually know that. I think that this is very interesting in your comments about the culture of safety and high quality that is reflected by performing this exam. That's a very compelling argument, but it just seems to me that there are parts of this measure that are inadequately developed.
Okay, let's go on to vote on 1531, follow-up assessment of stroke or death after revascularization, importance to measure and report.
Before the vote, can I just point out that a part of the scientific acceptability that you have to look at is testing, and there is no information, and we do have the information that reliability has not been tested.
So, importance of measure. One yes, 13 no.
Seven.
Oh, excuse me. 7 yes, 13 no. I'm reading the wrong numbers. Okay.
Do we want to request that the ACC consider revamping this and bringing it back?
If I may make one suggestion, we play in this vascular field in the state of Washington, and one of the things that's become very obvious is the tension, not necessarily the tension, but the relationship between and amongst the three specialties who do this work. I think this is an important measurement, but I think it would be a problem if we were to bless one professional entity with a measurement that impacts three different specialties. And so my invitation is not coming from the rest of the group, is that you have more hopefully productive discussions with the other disciplines, because if we're brought as a combined effort and identified as such, I think it might have a little more weight.
I would concur with that, speaking as a vascular surgeon. I think we all do need to get on the same page, because it's better for our patients.
Okay, let's move on to the next set, which is general ophthalmology, orthopedics, and pediatrics. And we're going to go slightly out of order here. We'll start with 352, Dr. Sipperstein, failure to rescue in-hospital mortality, risk-adjusted.
If I could just interject, we haven't heard from the developer on this one just yet.
Hi, Jeff, do you want to speak to the group?
I'm sorry, was I supposed to give a brief overview of failure to rescue? Is that?
Only if you want to. We're inviting you to give a brief overview of the CHOP measures.
If there are no specific questions, this is a measure that has been previously endorsed, and this is in the renewal process. We have updated codes for both the 30-day measure and the in-hospital measure. Failure to rescue is an outcome measure that is risk-adjusted. It is something that complements mortality and complication statistics, and has been used for a number of years to examine how hospitals handle patients who develop complications. Let me leave it at that.
Okay.
So this measure is actually paired with the following measure, and I'll explain why. The concept of failure to measure was explained as the probability of death following a complication. And so the ratio really looks at the number of deaths divided by the number of patients who have had complications. And this concept is somewhat interesting in the quality arena, in that the concept is that just looking at crude mortality may not, even if risk adjusted, may not sort everything out for you. It also is paired with the concept that various safety measures that we do act to reduce but really do not completely eliminate complications. And that the other concept is that a good number of complications may be due to underlying patient conditions, things that we may not have control over. And so the concept is that once a patient has had a complication in the hospital, are the systems in place to prevent that from progressing to death? That's the bottom line concept. So it's a somewhat of a different dimension of quality than we classically look at. This measure proposes to look at general surgery, orthopedic, and vascular surgery cases, large bundle of CPT codes for each of those. Obviously, the feeling is that it's an important measure. There have been lots of papers written on it. It garners administrative data, so it's going to be fairly easy to gather the information. The measure is a maintenance measure, but this particular measure has not been used yet in public reporting. The difference between this measure, 352, and the next one, 353, differs only in this measure looks at in-hospital mortality, and the following measure looks at 30-day mortality. And in our conference call, we could clearly understand through administrative data how you get the in-hospital and had some questions in terms of the method of collection of the 30-day. Also, my parenthetically add that the there's another measure that we're going to be reporting that is very similar to this that has been in use and is used by a number of states already.
I was going to mention that the we envisioned that the 30-day measure could be used by data sets where 30 days is available, like Medicare data, whereas HCUP data would only have in-hospital data. So that was one of the reasons to have both a 30-day measure and a in-hospital measure. Also, the other measure, the ARC measure, is very, very different. That is a spin on failure to rescue, but it only includes patients who had a subset of the complications, so that they basically use about half the deaths that would be available in my original measures. So they are very, very different measures, and I've written a paper to show that, which is referenced in the packet.
So, Jeff, does that mean that the 30-day mortality measure should exclude patients who aren't in Medicare or some other system that catches 30-day mortality?
That if you're using the 30-day measure, then you need a data set that has 30-day mortality, such that, for example, Medicare data has the ability, if the beauty of Medicare data is that it has the ability to look at death at 30 days because you have the denominator file and you know when patients die. Problem with HCUP data is that it's in-hospital data, not linked over time. So there are many situations where you can't do 30-day mortality and you'd rather, and so you're left with in-hospital mortality, and that would, there are also situations where, for whatever reason, one wants to use in-hospital mortality. Most of the time, we will report our results using 30-day, if we have the ability to report 30-day data. So that's why I think it's important to have both measures, because there are many studies that are done or many analyses that are done with data that isn't linkable, and therefore they should have a uniform weight and a reasonable way to compute failure to rescue for in-hospital. And if it is linkable, then they have the 30-day measure.
So the patients in whom you're measuring 30-day mortality, should there be an exclusion that to not include patients that are not in Medicare?
No, it depends on the data set that you have. If you have data that is linkable, it's not just Medicare data, there's other data sets. I gave that as an example. Maybe I'm not understanding your question, but...
Okay, so what we're talking about here is in reporting that hospitals or facilities could choose whichever data set they have and report one measure or the other?
Well, just like someone would report 30-day mortality or they would report in-hospital mortality, this is comparable, 30-day failure to rescue or in-hospital failure to rescue. So when I think about how I, when I look at different reporting sets, for example, there are state reporting systems where they're not linked to death certificates, and therefore they often use in-hospital mortality. There are other reporting systems where they do have linkable data, and they can look at 30-day mortality. The original reason to use 30-day mortality was that you didn't want to miss, you didn't want to have the problem of being discharged sicker and quicker and being and dying outside the hospital. That was always the worry, the bias that might occur if there were differences in length of stay that could lead to different biases, lead to biases in the reporting of hospitals that discharge patients very quickly. Maybe their death rates would look better. If you have a linkable data set and you can use 30-day mortality, you don't have to worry about that particular bias. That's always been the drawback with in-hospital mortality, is that people have been worried that hospitals with different styles of practice might show up differently in terms of in-hospital. So we think it's important to have both measures. There are problems when people are more concerned. There are situations where people are more concerned about that, and they should be able to do 30-day, or if they don't have 30-day data, use in-hospital.
just like people will report both rates, 30-day and in-hospital for mortality, we would think it would be important to be able to report both rates for failure to rescue.
Okay, thank you.
Given that you're risk adjusting the results, why are you cutting it off at 90?
Oh, well, there was a situation where we were worried that one might have a greater chance of not wanting to rescue after some age. So we decided that 90 was a reasonable cutoff. In other words, that the intent to rescue might be different when one gets exceedingly old.
I think that's ageist, but aside from that, if it's in your risk adjustment model, it shouldn't matter, and why not get all the data and report all the data?
You know, we have gone back and forth on this over the years and came out with 90 being what we thought was a reasonable way to look at the numbers. I can't imagine there would be huge differences between the two. Our sense is that whenever you're using a mortality measure, there are always issues with mortality that relate to questions of DNR, et cetera, which generally in these kinds of databases, you don't have uniform DNR reported, you don't have it collected or reported uniformly. So that's why we decided to use that 90 cutoff. I would think that if one was using public reporting and included patients up through 90, that would still do a very good job at getting at whether the hospital has the ability to handle patients who develop complications. In terms of being ageist, which I'm not, we looked at this mainly from a measurement perspective and worrying about unobservables. But I think that if there was a concern that some hospitals were specifically under caring for the very, very old, a change in that definition could be made. But I'd say that in most of the work that we've done, it made sense to have some upper bound. But that's what we've developed up to now, and that's the way we developed the measure. Not thinking that it would have a huge change, but we thought it would be slightly less. Put it this way, the data would be a little bit more comparable if we kept it at that upper bound of 90, but I'd have to consider going back and seeing if there was some great need to change that.
One question I have is the measure is looking at the percentage of patients with a complication who died. But in the numerator and in the denominator, it looks like people who didn't have a complication who died are also included. And I'm sort of trying to understand how you describe the measure then if you're including people who didn't have a complication, but it's about people who had complications. That's what I'm having trouble with.
Right. This is the way that I've developed this since the very beginning. I think it's important to look at this in terms of why people die. And in general, the general way that I've looked at this is that in order to die, or the probability of death is equal to the probability of dying given a complication times the probability of a complication plus the probability of dying given no complication times the probability of no complication. What we've thought was that since the probability of death given no complication is generally pretty low in the surgical arena, that what we're really looking at is that death equals the probability of a complication times the probability of death given a complication. There are instances where people die without complications. We call the opposite of that the precedence rate. We want to develop a measure that covers the deaths. So the way we construct the complication list is that we try to get most of the patients, the great majority of patients who died, we try to have a list of complications that includes the patients who died. So for in-hospital, that means about 95% of the patients who died had a preceding complication. In the cases where patients die without a preceding complication, the assumption is if they went through surgery, they probably had something go wrong with them before that. So we make sure that we cover all the deaths, and so the failure rate is, it's always an adjusted measure, but the numerator are the number of deaths. The denominator are the number of complications plus this very small little piece, which is the number of patients who died without a complication but still underwent surgery. So the number, they're doing it that way allows us to count all the deaths, and what we basically say is that this is an undocumented complication, that the patient had an undocumented complication. They had surgery, they died after surgery, something went wrong. In some way, we can document that, in some way, we know that something didn't go right, and the patient died. So if we're talking about these conditions that we've been studying, you know, the situation is that these patients had something that went wrong, otherwise they wouldn't have died, they weren't dead when they went into surgery, and so that's why it's kind of filling in that gap. The very, very different thing is used with the ARC measure, where they use a subset of complications, but they never worry about covering all the deaths, and therefore they lose about 50% of the deaths with a very, very limited set of complications. The way I set up my list of complications is I start by saying, what are the complications that are associated with death, and try to get all those complications. When you do that, you end up with in the elderly population, roughly speaking, between 40 and 50% of patients have some complication. If I would not be concerned with covering the complications, but only use deaths following the complication, as they do in the ARC definition, then I would end up with greatly disturbing the reliability of the measure because the number of deaths gets cut in half.
Okay.
There is that small little piece of patients who die without a complication. It's very rare, and it has differences in the way the claims data pick up some of the complications. But that's a small piece that we try to minimize by setting up a broad enough list of complications, which is how what we presented, that cover almost all the deaths.
All right. Thank you. I think that has actually very good case validity. Whenever there's a death within 30 days after an operation, we have to assume that the operation is what led to the death. Even if that's not actually true, that's the assumption so that we can take the best possible care of our patients and scrutinize our practices to try and make them better. So I think that it seems very valid to me. Firstly, anybody else in the room want to speak to that?
Well, one exception might be trauma, where the patient comes in and gets a desperate procedure in a bid to save their life and then dies.
And it still gets presented in the morbidity and mortality conference.
Yeah, but this covers general surgery, orthopedics, and vascular.
I think these things are innovative, interesting, and seem to be valid measures. The trouble is in the public understanding of these and the public reporting because they're complicated and they're a little harder to understand. Now, that doesn't mean we don't endorse them or think about that, but I think that creates some degree of difficulty using these measures as publicly reported measures. If everybody uses them and we can compare institution to institution, that's maybe makes it easier, but they are a little hard to wrap your brain around unless you've been doing it for a while.
Actually, if you don't understand anything about it, it's simple to understand because the lower death rate is better. If you understand a little, it becomes complicated. If you understand everything, it becomes simple again.
One of the problems in the 30-day, in interpretation of the 30-day result in mortality is going to be there is now increasing data that shows that the ultimate disposition of the patient and care outside of the
initial hospitalization or institution has a significant impact on, you know, readmission rates, subsequent postoperative complications. This is some information that's come out recently in the surgical literature. So how does your measure take into account those variables that in are outside the control of the initial hospitalization, if you will, and those involved?
Right. Well, I mean, looking at mortality would have the same issue. You know, if you looked at 30-day mortality, you'd say, well, it's possible that it wasn't our fault that something went wrong outside the hospital and therefore the patient died. It's always going to be the case when you have a measure that doesn't include just the in-hospital, but at the same time, we all recognize that in part the hospital is in part responsible for this in terms of where they discharge the patient to. So, you know, I would say that we wouldn't as a group say no one can look at 30-day mortality. It is often the gold standard. But it does suffer from that problem that you mentioned, and it has to be thought about in the same way failure to rescue would have suffering from that same issue anytime you talk about a mortality rate that's occurring outside the hospital. Our sense is that to get a good picture of the hospital, you're still going to need 30 days. That most of the time, most of the deaths are occurring fairly early. Secondly, the alternative of only looking at in-hospital has its problems and its bias too. So what you're saying isn't unique to failure to rescue. It's true for any measure that has a set point in time that can occur outside the hospitalization, but those are often considered to be the gold standard measures, and if there are caveats about who's to blame for this, I think that has to be addressed with future research, and there might be certain situations where people are very, very worried about this, but if you're evaluating a hospital, they in part should be responsible for when they discharge the patient, what happens to them. Same is true for readmission, right? I mean, and maybe you, so are we going to...
We're not going to talk about readmission right now.
Right, okay.
Anybody else on the committee want to make any comments or ask any questions?
I just have one more question, and maybe it's philosophical, but I'd like to know why a group from CHOP would propose an adult measure and why you wouldn't propose a pediatric measure. I understand the complications in that population are different, but why... It would seem to me that your vested interest would be in your pediatric population.
Well, I have received my PhD in health services research in 1990 using Medicare data. I had been doing research in both adult and pediatric diseases since that time. So I have a long experience with using claims data in adults and thinking about surgical problems in adults and pediatrics. So I've never let the particular age influence my research, age of the patient influence my research areas. And the nice thing about being at CHOP is, you know, I'm a professor at University of Pennsylvania. I'm a professor at Wharton. I am a professor at the medical school. They've been wonderful about letting me do my work in all different areas. The fact that my primary appointment is in pediatrics is why this is a CHOP measure. Why this comes from the word Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is there, but, I have been doing work in adult surgery for, over 20 years. So that's why it happens to be just, the fact that I originally, am board certified in pediatrics and I happen to be at Penn in the Department of Pediatrics. I'm also in the Department of Anesthesiology.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on the committee have any questions specifically for Dr. Silver about this measure?
I have a quick question for Carol. Do you have any concern that the basis for this is administrative data, recognizing the dissonance between what actually happened and what gets coded?
I think I don't have a problem with this. You know, and I think that... you know, we've used the ARC measure for a number of years, which, again, has some differences. But, administrative data is useful. There's just some things correlate better than others.
is it going to be good enough to pick up conditions present on admission?
It doesn't look like this has present on admission as a consideration. So that obviously would be a question, you know, is whether it should.
It, this looks like it's based on the presence of an ICD-9 complication code, and I was wondering if there was an increasing incentive to not report those if you don't get paid for that admission.
And actually, we're seeing more and more codes being submitted rather than less and less for a variety of reasons, probably because of presence on admission and so on.
Okay, are we ready to vote on Measure 352? Failure to rescue in-hospital mortality risk adjustment. First of all, does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report? And the results are 18 yes, 3 no. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for scientific acceptability of measure properties? Nine say completely, 11 partially, 1 minimally. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for usability? Seven say completely, 12 partially, 2 minimally. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for feasibility? Well, that 21st person hit your button again and then hit send. Eight say completely, 12 partially, 1 minimally. And then lastly, does the measure meet all of the NQF criteria for endorsement? Eight say yes. Three say no. The next measure is...
Can I just ask one quick question? Sure. So one of the statements made at the beginning of this was that this was not publicly reported. If I'm not mistaken, did I hear that correctly? That this is not in the public domain in terms of a reporting?
No, it's just not currently in use.
Okay. Does the fact that we have endorsed it, Will that automatically move it into publicly reporting, or is there a whole other series?
No, my understanding is it's a maintenance measure, just has not yet been picked up and adopted by any organizations.
What you would want to hear is the plan for public reporting within this endorsement period, within this next 3 years.
So before I go to the next one, can I just make a comment and make sure that we somehow at some point when we're talking about harmonization, harmonize these with the already two endorsed NQF measures that are AHRQ measures? So that's 200 and 0351. They were both, it looks like, last endorsed September 2010, according to the NQF website.
So the consideration of... harmonization or competing measures will be taken up around these three measures.
Okay, great.
Okay, the next one is 353, failure to rescue 30-day mortality. We had a little bit of a discussion about, well, we really discussed this already. And we can move on to the vote. The one thing that still isn't truly clear to me is whether hospitals are supposed to go after 30-day mortality among non-Medicare patients. It's nice to have alternative means of measuring these things, but the way that it stands right now, it looks like this is not really an alternative measure to the first one, that it's an additional measure to the first one. So for non-Medicare patients, how feasible is identifying 30-day mortality among post-operative patients? Anybody want to say anything else about that before we go ahead and vote? Okay. Does measure meet any of criteria for importance to measure and report? Please hit your button again. Hit send again.
He's out of the room.
We're missing something?
We only have 20.
Okay. 17 say yes, 3 say no. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for scientific acceptability of measure properties? Say completely, 12 partially, 2 say minimally. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for usability? Please say completely, 10 say partially, 8 say minimally. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for feasibility? Three say completely, 10 say partially, 7 say minimally, and 1 says not at all. And lastly, does the measure meet all of the NQF criteria for endorsement? So 13 say yes, 8 say no. So among our considerations for this, one is that we'd like to know the plan for public reporting, and the other is that we would like to look at harmonization with the ARC, among the other measures, the ARC measures. Big pardon? Okay. Is that...
Thank you.
Okay, great. So... Sorry? Okay. So we're gonna actually jump around a little bit here and go to 1550.
Kristen, thank you very much, and I guess we're talking with you again tomorrow.
That's right. Yes. All right. Thanks a lot, Dr. Silver.
Bye-bye.
So 1550, hospital level risk standardized complication rate following elective primary total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty. And this is being presented by Dr. Carpenter.
Yeah, I'll present this. So this is a newly proposed measure.
I'm sorry, let me interrupt you for just a second. So another developer is going to...
The developers haven't had a chance to do a brief update, if that's okay. Okay. She was on the train earlier, if you recall.
Gotcha. So. Okay. Would you like to give a brief update?
Yeah.
Into the microphone? So we developed two complementary administrative claims-based measures for patients undergoing primary, elective, total hip arthroplasty, and total knee arthroplasty. We developed a risk-standardized complications measure and a 30-day all-cause readmission rate. We developed the measures for these procedures because they're high volume, high cost procedures, in a cohort of Medicare fee-for-service patients in 2008, there were over 100,000 hip arthroplasties performed across 3,000 hospitals and 241,000 knee arthroplasties performed across 3,300 hospitals. And that was after we excluded patients with hip fractures and patients undergoing partial hip arthroplasties, revision procedures, and resurfacing procedures. And the trend in performance of these procedures is projected to increase. The cost is high, and that is projected to increase also. We developed these measures over 12 months with extensive input from nationally recognized leaders in the orthopedic surgery community, including the past and current presidents of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, past president of the American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons. And again, we developed two measures that assess separate domains of quality, a complications measure that captures overall care and reflects the technical aspects of the procedure, and that's targeted toward, geared toward more targeted QI improvement efforts, and a readmission measure, which globally measures care, including transitional care. It is a risk-adjusted measure. It's risk-adjusted for patient case mix, age, gender, number and type of procedure. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Carpenter?
Thanks. So you get a flavor for what these are. These are useful to think about together. The complications data in terms of importance and impact, again, they're high volume, costly procedures, and they're growing. The overall rate of these complications is about 7%. So it's not super high, but it's significant. The range is around 2 to 9% that they report. So there is quite a variable range from different institutions. They did limit the complications to what I think are appropriate ones, including death, mechanical complications, infection, bleeding, PE, MI, pneumonia, and sepsis. So it's not every little tiny complication. There's some, it can be some debate about how severe a wound infection is, but that, other than that, I think it's a good option. The follow-up timing is interesting, and because it's 90 days for some of these complications, 30 days for others, and 7 days for others. So that makes it a little bit more complicated. But it is a claims data measure, so hopefully that's all available. It is limited to patients 65 and older, I think because that's where the data is good. A lot of patients, I don't know the percentage, but I would say 25 or so percent, maybe 30% of these procedures are done in patients under 65, so there is a segment of people that are not included in these measures. Exclusions, I think, are appropriate, transverse hip fractures and revision surgery. The risk adjustment method is complicated, sophisticated. I don't think I understood it all, but it's a hierarchical linear regression that ends up reporting a predicted complication rate versus an expected complication rate, predicted based on your past performance of your institution and how you would do, and expected based on the mix of patients that you have. So it's sort of like an observed to expected. That's how I understood that. So I think it seems valid. There's a lot of math in there. So it's a little hard to understand, but I think it is valid. It is similar to other measures that I think are already approved for MI and heart failure. So some of those same techniques have been used, I assume successfully, although I don't know. So that's basically the complications one, and maybe we should just stop there, and then we can discuss the other one. But the other one won't, once we get through this, the other one won't take very long. And just in terms of the, I was not on the conference call, so I don't know all the discussion. There was some concern about the 65-year-olds, why it was limited to that, and some discussion about the risk adjustment technique.
Can somebody that was on the call speak to that, the concern about the risk adjustment technique? Dr.
I don't remember if we what type of discussion we had exactly. I know we spoke about the different number of days for each of the complications, and part of the thought was that likely there's something in the literature that correlates 7 days for sepsis, 30 days or 90 days is not going to be able to be tracked back to that particular surgery. But that's the only discussion I remember having.
I would agree. I think, yeah, it was predominantly on the variability in the length of follow-up for the complications. And then just one question about two outcomes. Readmissions and re-ops. Were they factors that were looked in and that dropped out of the analysis, or have they not been included?
So this measure, the first measure is just those complications I listed. So they had readmissions that we'll talk about next as a separate reportable measure. But they generally are going to fall into one of these categories: mechanical failures such as a fracture or dislocation, or an infection or bleeding. So generally the reasons for reoperation and readmission would be captured with these complications if they happened in that time frame.
Can you clarify why acute MI, pneumonia, and sepsis were not included in a 30-day window, but rather in a 7-day window?
Yes. It was clinically driven, and we wanted to capture the important medical complications, and we felt that in order to be attributable to the procedure, we set the cutoff at 7 days, because anything beyond that, it would be hard to attribute in this population to the procedure.
Jim, what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think, you know, they had a lot of discussion. I think they're, you know, I'd applaud them for including a good group of people experienced with these procedures in their technical panel. So I think that was probably well vetted and gone over pretty thoroughly. It seems reasonable to me.
It's a philosophical problem, though, because if we've got, if the public perceives that most surgical outcomes are going to be framed within a 30-day follow-up period, and now they have to, well, wait a minute, is this 7 days? Is this 14 days? One of the things that we should be discussing is somewhat of a standardization of reporting these outcomes. And to have different ones for different procedures and different, you know, areas concerns me.
I just had a question of whether the Yale team had actually done any analyses to see if you maintained all of them at 30 days, which would be certainly more standard, how much higher did the complication rate go, and was there significant concern related to attribution? I mean, in general, we're kind of going away from the idea that it has to be directly related to the procedure, as you do in all the all-cause readmission measures. I'm just curious.
We didn't look at that specifically, but what we looked at the trend in the rates over 90 days, and for the AMI, pneumonia, and sepsis, they peaked within 7 days and then dropped and went down to baseline. And we looked at the trend over 90 days for all the complications. So that was clinical input, and based on an analysis of the data, that informed the decision to set the follow-up period for each complication.
And if a patient goes to a SNF, are they included still? Just a question.
If they're discharged to a SNF, yes.
And just remember that part of the response to your question about the rehospitalization is that this is paired with a readmission measure, so those sort of readmissions that are less related but are less related to the procedure but more about the sort of overall quality of care and transition are going to be captured in the complementary measure. So that was part of the thinking there as well.
Any other discussion, comments?
Yeah, I just have a quick question, and you talk about it in your exclusions, but it still isn't clear to me why you would exclude DVT and UTI just because screening practices are different.
Yeah, we did have a lot of discussion about that, and the codes that are used vary, and particularly with DVT, screening varies considerably across sites, and readmission for screening varies. The complications we chose are associated with readmission. You had to get readmitted for the complication. And the surgeons felt that with the other two, it would just be, some of the codes aren't very specific, particularly those for UTI. And with DVT, there was just so much variability in screening and readmission rates that it wouldn't be it wouldn't be helpful to include.
But GVT is one of the more common complications, and people don't always screen for it. You're correct. It actually often picks up when somebody complains about it. So routine screening for GVT in most surgical populations isn't done. But it would seem to me that you're going to miss a significant number of patients. I'm not an orthopedist, but it's one of the things that the orthopedists are worried about, and this is what we all argue about when it comes to what kind of DVT prophylaxis you use. So certainly at least DVT, I think, is something that you really need to think about, and UTIs in the elderly population are something that are common enough as well. And if you don't throw those out, if you throw those out, then maybe your teens aren't getting those Foley catheters out within 24 hours, which is one of these skip measures. So just a couple of thoughts.
I'll make a comment about the DVT. I think, and I've obviously they discussed this thoroughly, but the problem, this is a claims database. So what you, if you could identify symptomatic DVTs versus ones picked up that are asymptomatic from screening, that might be helpful. But because this database couldn't separate those out, it's really going to be dependent on how much screening is done in those patients, because the risk for a below-knee asymptomatic DVT in these procedures is very high. So if you're going to screen everyone, you're going to find a lot of those. If you're going to screen no one, you're not going to find very many of them, and especially in this window. So I think it's not that it's not important. It just probably wasn't reliable in the measurement enough to include. And I guess that would be, and probably a measure isolated just on DVT prophylaxis and measurement should be developed. But right now, I don't think the technology and the use is there.
It was mentioned that one of the concerns the work group had raised was the age 65. Can you explain why it isn't including younger people?
Sure. This is really, at this point, a matter of data availability. As with our other measures, we've developed this in the Medicare claims data. And within the Medicare claims data, the younger than 65 group is a very narrow group. Right? If you get into Medicare before 65, it's end-stage renal disease patients and patients with disabilities. We have been doing a lot of work to look at our other measures and see how well they work in broader populations. And like this, and as with this measure, we actually expect that the measure would work pretty well in those other populations and would hope to have its use in those populations eventually. But at this point, it was just a matter of data availability. And we've had some discussions with CMS about bringing to us all population-level measures. So I guess, since it's already been brought up here as well, again, one recommendation from the committee could be to specifically request that those specifications, when available, come to NQF. Because, again, this comes up again and again, and then we wind up getting measures for the below 65 population, and then we spend inordinate months harmonizing them. So try to avoid that.
That work is underway.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, let's go ahead and vote. On measure 1550, does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report? Nineteen say yes, one says no. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for scientific acceptability of measure properties? The 11 say completely, 8 say partially, 1 says minimally. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for usability? Some say completely, 10 say partially. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for feasibility? Can say completely, 10 say partially. Sorry, 6. I don't know where that came from. Uh-oh. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement?
20 say yes. 0 say no or abstain. All right. And then the next measure, 1551, hospital level 30-day all-cause risk standardized readmission rate following elective primary total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty. We have really pretty much had the discussion here, but Tim, did you have more to add?
Not really. It's actually a simpler measure than the previous one, and I think it's because they use all causes for readmission other than readmission for elective procedures such as the other hip or the other knee. I think it's simpler. They use the same risk adjustment strategy, and it's all at 30 days, so again, that makes it simpler. So I think this is a little more straightforward than the other.
Any other comments from the group or questions? Let's go ahead and vote. Does measure meet NCAL criteria for importance to measure and report? Twenty say yes. Does measure meet NCAL criteria for scientific acceptability of measure properties? A 15 say completely, 5 say partially. Does measure meet NCAL criteria for usability? Can say completely, 4 say partially. So the measure meet NCAL criteria for feasibility. 14 say completely, 6 say partially. And lastly, does the measure meet all the NCAL criteria for endorsement? And 19 say yes, 1 says no.
Just one clarification. Does the developer intend these to be truly paired measures, meaning they should always be reported together? You used the word paired earlier. I just wanted to check if that's what you intend.
They were developed to be complementary, but we did not intend that they couldn't be separated.
Yes.
Right.
It means something very different, that's all.
Okay.
Okay. Back up to the top. Okay. Since we had our discussion not that long ago around the topic of 351, we'll go back to that. 351, death among surgical inpatients with serious treatable complications. This is the ARC measure.
Could I provide a little background on that from the developer's perspective?
Yes, thank you.
Right, so I appreciate hearing the discussion of the earlier indicators, so let me provide a little bit of historical perspective that may not have been clear from the documents. So this measure was definitely inspired by the work that Jeff Silber and his colleagues have done over the last 20 years. So it reflects the same underlying concept of what he calls failure to rescue or what we call death following serious potentially treatable complications. At the time that this measure was developed by AHRQ as part of the Quality Indicators Program, we surveyed the field to find different specifications of this concept for administrative data, because the original specification was actually based on a more complex data set. It was a proprietary data set. Jack Needleman and Peter Bierhaus did a large study that was funded by HRSA looking at the impact of nurse staffing. And they convened an expert panel to help them identify measures that would be sensitive to nurse staffing and nursing skill mix. So they identified this as such a measure, and they specified it based on patients having one of six complications to get into the denominator. So their expert panel felt that these six complications were complications that were particularly serious and where a rapid response effort could identify the complication early and potentially slow or prevent the progression. So Needleman and Bierhaus operationalized this specification based on these six complications for the denominator, showed that it was valid based on their work on nurse staffing. We were familiar with that work and consulted with Needleman and Bierhaus. We convened our own expert panel under ARC's auspices, and they basically agreed that they liked the concept of failure to rescue, but they preferred a specification in which the denominator was linked to specific types of complications that they could get their arms around clinically, where they felt that there was a particular opportunity for early intervention and thus actionability for improvement. So that was the concept. And that's how this measure came to be the original NQF-endorsed measure of failure to rescue. When Silber and I are friends, I was actually a co-author on the paper that he describes comparing these different specifications, so I have nothing bad to say about his measure, his work. But he decided to seek NQF endorsement for his measures separately, and at that time, the ARC measure was already endorsed, and there was no mechanism at that time for harmonization. So this is an opportunity for kind of revisiting the underlying question and potentially harmonizing. Jeff and I did together a comparative analysis of these specifications. And as you might expect, his specification offers somewhat higher reliability because of the fact that it includes all the deaths as opposed to only including half the deaths. The construct validity is actually similar in terms of the correlation with measures of nurse staffing, skill mix, teaching status, board certification of physicians, so forth. So measures of construct validity are similar. The ARC measure is a little somewhat less sensitive to patient characteristics. The Silber measure is somewhat more sensitive to patient characteristics, and thus potentially to confounding due to those characteristics. Those numbers are all on the paper. Happy to share that with the group if you're interested. So in terms of the going forward, obviously the ARC measure is available in public use software, and therefore it's been picked up more broadly in public reporting applications by a variety of states and other reporting organizations. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's superior. It's just the product of a different expert panel process with Needleman and Bierhaus's panel on nurse staffing and then our panel on the inpatient quality indicators. So we are open to your suggestions and comments related to opportunities for harmonization.
Thank you. Dennis?
After that, there's not tons to say. Again, this is a maintenance measure that looks at outcomes data based on all discharges with a disposition of deceased. And again, unlike 353, which talks about 30-day mortality, this is only in-hospital mortality that they're going after the data on. So the data set is a little bit smaller. We discussed this in the group, and the consensus really was that these two measures really needed to be brought together, actually the three of them, and needed to be completely paired and kind of brought together into maybe one, definitely two measures that could be harmonized and utilized. And probably the biggest advantage so far with 351 is that it is being reported to the public, unlike the other two, which are collecting data that is just collecting. So that is clearly the thing the committee felt that was the most efficacious of this, is that it is
currently being reported.
It sounds like there's another potential advantage, which is the goal of this is to improve rescue.
Right.
And if these are conditions for which there is potentially a more easy to identify rescue process, then that also could be advantageous. And maybe that could be considered during what I hope would be a harmonization process. Anybody else have questions?
Another advantage is the age range, which goes down to 18, I think. But that's really important for state reporting, for health plan reporting, for all kinds of things to include that broader population.
And it actually even goes lower than that with certain conditions.
Feel free to include the 90-year-olds.
I'm sorry, no. It's 18 is the lower limit.
Yeah, my grandmother's going to kick you in the shins.
Anybody else? Let's go ahead and vote then. Does the measure meet NCAP criteria for importance to measure and report? One can say yes, one says no. Does the measure meet NCAP criteria for scientific acceptability of measure properties? Can say completely, 7 say partially. Does the measure meet NCAP criteria for usability? So can say completely, 7 say partially. Does the measure meet NCAP criteria for feasibility? I can say completely, I say partially. Does the measure meet all the NCAP criteria for endorsement? Can say yes, one says no. What we're looking at here is harmonization. Also, I think based on the stuff that Richard was bringing up, consideration of changing the upper age limit, and then the plan for public reporting among the CHOP measures.
It's actually more than just harmonization, because they're all claims-based measures. It would be difficult, I think, to think about how they could coexist, or can they come together in a better way.
Will there be further discussion of the harmonization question tomorrow, or...
All right, so moving on to measure 339, pediatric heart surgery mortality.
Do I dare say that we can go through this quickly because we're dealing with small patients in small numbers? All right, let me just bring up our... these two measures, certainly one is, I think, from a no-brainer point of view to discuss and vote on. The 339 looks at pediatric heart surgery and mortality in a risk-adjusted fashion, dealing with the congenital heart surgery in an age population 18 and under. To cut to the evaluation of our group, I think in terms of, I think, just about all of the categories, our group felt that though there was some variability in terms of meeting partial to complete concordance with the requirements, that our work group felt that this was a valid metric, and thought that it
met all of the criteria to be proposed and put forward. There are some concerns in that, in terms of its presentation, it does seem to lack, it would be nice if they'd have included some current data. It's a maintenance measure, and so they've gotten some years of data, and it would be nice to see some of the results. The problem is, of course, as many, you know, it's limited to a certain number of institutions in the country, and the numbers actually are not increasing. They've been flat to decreasing in terms of overall congenital heart surgery. But our group thought that this was a valid metric for proposal and support. The volume, if you want me to just continue, will 0340 is right on its heels in terms of looking at volume, and clearly meant, excuse me, as a paired process. Again, in terms of the write-up, the citations are quite old. There is no lack of current data. Our group, I must admit, felt that for the most part the criteria were met. Many of us felt that some of it were partially, certainly from a scientific and feasibility point of view. The problem I have, again, it gets into a personal bias of dealing with just a pure volume report, particularly in this situation where the numbers are just so small, and whether it's sensitive enough to pick up any differences in terms of institutional performance. The cut number, I think, in the literature that was quoted was 200 cases or so, and there are very few programs that are doing those numbers, and as they cited in the literature, many programs are well below that, 100 cases or less. And so, again, I'm not sure, this will be obviously a personal bias injected here, that the reporting of volume in pediatric congenital heart surgery is a suitable or valid measure. Certainly mortality is.
Anybody have any questions or comments about that? I want to request from the developer that the references be updated.
We do. We actually do have updated references. I'm sorry if they didn't get to you. There have been Dr. Welke's group affiliated with STS has done some work more recently on this issue. I'm not sure if anyone is familiar with that work, basically showing a consistent volume-outcome relationship. There was one study from California that showed a weakening of the relationship, but the problem there is that the system is already highly regionalized, and one hospital actually had much higher volume than any other hospital in the state. And so it was a highly skewed distribution. It wasn't typical of the nation as a whole. So the more recent literature is consistent. We'll get to harmonization issues later. But this measure is really based on the so-called RACS one scheme that has been published on fairly extensively in the literature.
In terms of the volume, the real problem has come in the fact that it's becoming so regionalized. I mean, it is getting driven into just certain institutions. And so for that reason, does volume no longer become a valid measure of quality here?
Okay. Let's go ahead and move on to the vote. I think that's an important point. Probably will become more important over time with other rare operations. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report? Eight teams say yes, one says no. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. Four teams say completely, six say partially. Usability. system stay completely or stay partially? Feasibility. System stay completely, three stay partially, one says minimally. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Eighteen say yes, one says no. The next measure, 340, is up for vote next, and Dr. Dillon brought up the important point that these are being driven into a few sort of high-volume centers. Do we want to discuss that now, or is that just something to note?
Just one more clarification that my understanding is the volume measure is paired with the mortality measure. So the idea would be if somebody's looking to see which center they want to go to as a parent or someone, that potentially information you'd want to see paired with mortality, but probably not as a standalone, which is why it's paired.
If I could just say the other obvious thing, that the practice of pediatric heart surgery has changed drastically in the last 20 years, probably as much as aortic aneurysm surgery, and that sort of the so-called bread and butter of pediatric heart surgery, ASDs, VSDs, PDAs, coarcs, are virtually never operated on or only occasionally operated on, and almost everything is at a higher level of complexity. And that influences a whole lot of things, but one of the principal things that it does is invalidate a big body of literature from the more distant past.
Another good reason to update the literature on that. Let's go ahead and vote. Does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report? Four teams say yes, five say no. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. Ten say completely, eight say partially, one says minimally. Usability. Ten say completely, eight say partially, one says minimally. Feasibility. Thirteen say completely, six say partially. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Everybody, please hit your button one more time and hit send.
Aiming at Jessica.
You 15 say yes, 4 say no. All right. I'd like to kind of take the group's pulse here on measures. 515 and 301. Do we want to table these till tomorrow morning? Okay.
Well, do we have people who, can't attend?
Oh, are you unable to attend tomorrow?
No, sorry.
We can attend tomorrow, but I was just going to request if it could be in the morning with the other measure because Dr. Shapiro has a commitment.
Can I just say that updated information about references was sent out to everybody, but it's just been our update. Within the last day or two, some of you may also have been traveling, so among your souvenirs through email, there is an attachment with updated references.
What time are you starting for?
I'm afraid to ask potential surgeons, but I do.
Might want to start a little earlier.
So we're scheduled to start tomorrow at 9 o'clock. In terms of leaving your things in the room, is that not a good idea? We're going to go to another room tomorrow. It'll be next door, I think. But hopefully a little bit larger. And I think there are more cookies in there.
So before everyone departs, we do need to open the line for public and member comments.
Okay. All right, any comments? I don't hear anything. I think we're all set. Good night, everybody.